I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on the west side of New York City. Robert co-founded Friends of the High Line with Joshua Davin, whom he met at a community board meeting to protest the High Line's demolition in 1999. The park opened to the public in 2009. Robert and Josh are the authors of the book The High Line, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What does the High Line look like?
Well, I mean, it was originally an old elevated rail line. So, you know, when I first saw it, it was sort of this rusting structure. But now we've cleaned it up a little bit, and there's a park on top. So you're about three stories in the air walking through the city, you know, sometimes through buildings, and it gives you just all these different perspectives on the city.
Now, the High Line was first created in the 1930s as a safety mechanism, because you had trains at street level who were killing people, basically running them over, and then they were abandoned by 1980s. Why were they abandoned?
Because with the rise of interstate trucking, the line was used less and less, and, you know, its heyday was really, you know, right after it was built, 30s, 40s. But by the 60s, it was used less and less. And the last train was a trainload of frozen turkeys that ran at Thanksgiving, around right before Thanksgiving in 1980. So it wasn't that long ago that it was still, you know, an active train line. But, you know, and the trains ran, when you know, when you're saying people were killed, 10th Avenue was nicknamed Death Avenue because so many people were run over by the trains. And the railroad hired a guy on horseback to run in front of the trains, and he became nicknamed the West Side Cowboy.
What other deliveries were made, aside from frozen turkeys, to these buildings along the High Line?
I mean, it was actually a lot of food. The nickname for the High Line was the Lifeline of New York because it brought in a lot of food to Manhattan. And a lot of the buildings that are still next to the High Line used to be windowless refrigerated warehouses. And now they're offices and residences, and they punched windows through. Also, the Nabisco factory, which is now Chelsea Market at 15th Street, you know, they were baking cookies. You know, the train would actually bring in the eggs and the flours, and then the trains would take out the Oreos that would go all over the U.S.
So in 1999, the city and developers and residents were planning to demolish the High Line, and you attended a community board meeting to help protest this demolition. What were you doing at that moment in your life?
I was working for a watch retailer and helping them launch an internet division, sort of right during the internet boom. So my background was in, you know, for-profit startups, a lot of internet companies. And I read an article in the Times that the High Line was going to be demolished, and it had a little map, and it showed that it was a mile and a half long. And I'd seen parts of it, but I just thought it was all chopped up. And so that's when I thought, wow, this is, you know, a mile and a half of Manhattan. You know, that doesn't come around very often.
You mentioned this was in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and this was the heyday of internet startups, which helped 20-somethings like yourself, you know, think that they could run these multi-million-dollar companies. How much was that in your psychology of wanting to think big for yourself?
Oh, I think it was a huge part. Early 20-year-olds were taking companies public for hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, it didn't bother me that I didn't have any experience necessarily. But, you know, when we were starting it, I thought my role and Josh's role would just be to get it started, and then someone else would do it. But pretty quickly we found out some people might have been excited, but they didn't want to take it on.
You take a year off every 10 years. It just so happened that when you were thinking about starting this project for the High Line, it coincided with one of your years off. Can you describe how you decided ultimately to take that year to
Yeah, I mean, it's not a scientific process. It's just when I was in college, I met my boyfriend, or my first boyfriend, or the first guy I ever kissed, and we were not out of the closet. We didn't know what to do, so we dropped out of college told our parents we were taking a year off. And we ended up moving to Hong Kong and doing construction work and traveling in Southeast Asia, worked on the stock exchange here, and just it was a great year. I mean, it was an amazing year. It was so helpful. And that's when I made the promise to myself that I would try every 10 years or so, you know, to take some time off for myself. And then, you know, so it was really sort of a coincidence there. When I started, I was 29, and that watch retailer later in the year got bought out by Sunglass Hut. So I made a little bit of money and had enough money to take a year off. And I thought I would travel and figure out what I wanted to do next. But ended up staying in New York and focusing mostly on the High Line and was really enjoying it. But I still thought, oh, this is just something I'll do, you know, just during this year off.
And to what extent was your opposition to wanting to take this on initially the fact that you'd be running a nonprofit or, you know, socially minded organization versus a for-profit organization?
I mean, I definitely had never had any desire to run a nonprofit. You know, I'd never had any desire to go to a community board meeting before I went to that one. So, you know, that was part of it. I just didn't also think running a nonprofit could be that interesting. And that was a huge mistake.
Right.
And it's actually very similar to startups. Because, you know, when you're in a startup, more than half of your time is consumed by raising money. And that's the same thing in nonprofit. The problem is, you know, in a for-profit, either you stop making money and you go under. Nonprofit, the more successful you are, the more money you have to raise.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, the co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the creation of the High Line, an elevated public park in New York City. You went to Princeton, and you weren't openly gay until mid-college. What was that like for you growing up in Texas knowing that you were gay? Or did you not know at the time?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely knew, but I didn't really think about it that much. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was really fortunate to come out at a time when I did because it was a very much easier, you know, in the early 90s to come out than mm-hmm. I think even, you know, 5 years before. My parents were very supportive. My family was really supportive. And my friends were really supportive. So it really wasn't. And then I moved to New York where it's pretty easy.
Your parents were involved in civic-minded projects when you were growing up in San Antonio. For instance, your father helped to found Friends of the Parks in San Antonio. Is it accidental that you came to this place, or how did that inform what you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I always thought the High Line reminded me of my mother because my mother was always interested in odd projects and sort of taught me from a young age to see, sort of find beauty in odd places. And then it was, I don't know, maybe like 3 or 4, it might have been 5 years after I'd been working on the High Line that I realized that the things that my dad, when I was growing up, the things my dad did outside of work were he was involved in preservation, parks, and architecture. And, you know, here I was working on a project that combined all three of those things. You know, so I think I was sort of slow to see, and he was kind enough not to point it out.
Which implies a healthy relationship with your parents.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty lucky. I think I have had an atypical Texan childhood. I became obsessed with Russia when I was in middle school after reading Nicholas and Alexandra. And my parents let me go to Russia when I was in middle school by myself. And then they let me live over there for 3 years in high school in 87, which, you know, wasn't what most Texan parents, you know, wanted their kid to go live in the Soviet Union at the time.
What do your siblings do? You have a brother and a sister.
Yeah, my brother is an Episcopal priest in Fredericksburg and he lives there with his wife and two kids.
In Texas,
yeah. And my sister lives in Dallas, and she has 4 kids.
You mentioned that when you were doing the project, it seemed obvious to you that you were paralleling your mom's eccentric life to some degree. Your mom, for instance, kept bees in your living room in Texas, and she was also a kite maker and collector. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. The year I was born, she heard about the National Kite Flying Championship that happens on the Mall. The Smithsonian hosts it every year. She'd never really done anything before, but the rule was you had to make your own kite and fly it yourself. So she made a kite and went to Washington, and she won the National Kite Flying Championship. And then went on to collect, I think one time she had the largest collection of kites in the United States. She had several shows, made some making her own kites. And then, you know, she would, every few years, she would get a new hobby, from collecting brooms to animal vertebras to, you know,
whistles.
She doesn't whistle. I mean, you could probably name a top collection, the downstairs bathroom, the bathtub is filled with all different devices that make bubbles.
I read a quote. She said, "A kite and a person have many similarities. They both have skin and bones and rely on the same thing to get them going: air."
Yeah. When she said, when I was she loved the name Highline because high of kite flying. And she, there's, I don't know if it was her quote or someone else's, but she always used to say, it's hard to have bad thoughts when you're looking up. That, like, when you look down, one, you're usually not as happy, but it also makes you more unhappy. When you look up, you're just sort of already either happier or it makes you a little happier. And that's something, you know, it's connected to the Highline.
I want to go back to 1999 when you heard about this potential demolition of the High Line. You went to this community board meeting just as a concerned citizen in the West Village, and you happened to be sitting next to this guy, Joshua David, who became your partner. Did you both come up with the idea, you know, let's start this, or was it more of an eventual process?
It was more like, oh, you know, here's my business card. Oh, here's, you know, we exchanged business cards. And I said, well, I'm really busy. Why don't you do something? Mm-hmm. And I'll help. And he was like, well, I'm busier. You do it and I'll help, you know. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, well, let's talk.
David is a writer. And at the time, he was writing for magazines ranging from...
Yeah, Travel and Leisure, Gourmet, Wallpaper.
Were you at all in any way strange bedfellows?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons it worked is we are so different. His background was in writing and magazines. Mine was in startups. I think that's one of the things that has made it work is that we were precisely so different and that neither of us had any experience in planning, architecture. You know, that most people assume we were architects.
At what point did you say, you know what, we don't have a background in this. Let's come up with this competition.
From the beginning, we always said, he and I are not going to decide this. And that's why it was great that we weren't architects. I think if we had been architects, it would have been irresistible for us to want to design it.
Who were the architects for the project?
So it was led by James Corner Field Operations, who's a landscape architect. And he partnered with James Diller Scofidio and Renfro, architects, and also Pete Uldoff, who is the garden designer who picked a lot of the plants.
They became the designers of the project as a result of a competition that you held. And some other ideas in the competition ranged from a mile-long swimming pool to a roller coaster. What other ideas were there?
There was one idea where it was called a park prison. And the idea was sort of a political manifesto is that we should have to see the people that we imprison. So you'd have a park on the High Line, and in the I-beams in the middle, you would imprison people. So as you're having your leisure stroll, you'd also have to see people in prison. I mean, my favorite was the pool. This, because it was such a clean idea, this mile-long lap pool. And imagine, you know, swimming, you know, no lap turns. And then in the winter, it would become a, you know, a mile-and-a-half skating rink.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line. We'll hear more from Robert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on Manhattan's West Side in New York City. Friends of the High Line relies on support from members to fund the ongoing maintenance of the park, as well as the expansion of its third section to be completed in 2014. The design for the High Line was determined through this competition that you held. In what way was opening this up to the public strategic?
There was one of our early supporters, a guy, Phil Ahrens, and he said, you know, don't show people designs. And it was one of the best pieces of advice. And I always, whenever I'm talking to people that are starting their own projects, everyone wants to rush to get into the design and show what it's going to look like. And, you know, I think there was a real advantage not to, because people could then imagine things that they want to see up there. And that's when we had this photographer, Joel Sternfeld, go up and shoot the High Line. And Josh and I think of him as almost sort of the third co-founder, because he took these photos that sold the project for us. You know, you could look at it and say, well, you know, it's just an abandoned railroad with weeds growing on it. But, you know, it's weeds growing on an abandoned rail track with the Empire State Building in the background. So this is Manhattan. And so, you know, people looked at that and saw all different things. Some people saw a chance to build something. Some people saw a chance for a garden. Some people saw perennials. Some people saw the wild grasses. Some people saw preservation. Some people thought trains. You know, enabled us to really create a broad group of support, not just sort of a narrow, you know, just architects or just preservationists.
So the lack of specificity really helped to facilitate this current of interest.
Yeah. But what the beauty of it is that it all came back. Actually, ironically, to that very photo. When we asked people in the community, what did they want? They pointed to Joel's photo. And the beauty of what the design team did was they didn't just make it look exactly like that. They captured the spirit and the feeling of what was up there, but also added something new.
Ironically, the opposition to the project was almost helpful to you.
Yeah.
Can you describe that paradox?
Yeah. Well, at first when we came on board, you know, we really didn't know who we were up against. But then it became pretty clear that the city, led by Mayor Giuliani, was against it. He signed a demolition order 3 days before he left office. The property owners in the neighborhood had been organizing to tear it down for years. And actually, a lot of people in the neighborhood, you know, just thought it was an eyesore. Even if they thought it would be nice if it was a park, they thought, these two guys are never going to make it happen, so you should just get it over with and tear it down. But, you know, my elevator pitch was, it's a mile and a half Manhattan. How often do you get a chance to think about that? I'd show them the Joel Sternfeld photo. If that didn't work, I could always say, and Giuliani hates it. And then people go, oh, really? Then it must be a great idea. I'd be happy to help.
When did you become more and more certain that actually, you know what, this is something that can happen despite the intransigence of this prior?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was one of the last people to believe that it would really happen. I mean, I'm a dreamer, but I'm also a realist and knew the chances from the beginning were very small. And then as we started making a lot of progress, we had just so many, it was so complex with so many legal, financial, regulatory, and political hurdles and just engineering problems that I was just convinced it wouldn't have taken a lot for it all to fall apart. I mean, Josh and I, part of the one thing that we're very much alike is we always sort of worrying and seeing the problems coming up. So we had a development director one time who said she was the only organization she'd ever been at. When you got a $1 million check, we just kept our heads down and kept typing on the computer and kept working. And it's still, it's now just still sinking in that this actually not only happened, but is actually working, you know, that people are liking it.
You obviously faced just an abundance of opposition. What were some of the darkest, like, personal moments for you? Like, did it ever get to a point where you just didn't like what you were doing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, I like the process. The times I would get really upset and lose sleep, it was always interpersonal things.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, when Josh and I weren't getting along, you know, we've had our ups and downs. Most people, you know, assume that we're sort of best friends, and you know, it's been really tough, and there's been several points in the project where we didn't think we could keep working together, and you know, those were always in some ways the hardest time for me.
In the early days, you took the stance of you were neighborhood nobodies, you know, which...
Well, no, I didn't take... Someone called us neighborhood nobodies.
But you kind of ran with it. What's that quote? Don't be so humble. You're not that great yet.
Yeah. No, we definitely play the humble game. We definitely play that game a little bit.
Yet, even though you played that game, you were quite professional and quite deliberate about certain things, one of which was hiring lawyers versus asking lawyers to work pro bono for you.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think most nonprofits or maybe anybody, you know, is loath to do is pay lawyers a lot of money. But at the time, we needed to sue the city on a very specific rail use and land use issue, and the lawyers that could do it pro bono weren't the best in that area. And the lawyers that were the best are usually hired by the city or the railroad, and they didn't want to do a pro bono. So that's when we realized, you know, that's how developers get things done. They hire the really smart lawyers. And so we wanted to take a page from that book. The High Line wouldn't be standing today if it wasn't for those lawyers. And we had to pay. We had to pay a lot of money. And that's in the early days. It wasn't that glamorous, but that's what we were raising money for, was to pay these lawyers to stop the demolition.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line in New York City into a public space. I want to talk a little bit more about the opposition. Why was opposition to keeping the High Line so fierce? And what was one impediment that disappeared that kind of helped to open the floodgates?
Well, the High Line was an was a railroad CSX owned the High Line. But all they owned was the steel structure and a 30-foot easement above it. So there were 22 property owners that owned property underneath it and air rights above it. And they thought it would eventually come down, so they just wanted to tear it down. So that's why there was such opposition and a lot of money involved, because these developers, you know, had bought property hoping the High Line would come down so they could develop in that space. I mean, one of the developers said they spent over $3 million in legal fees fighting us. And then, you know, some people in the community, you know, to me, how romantic, a train running through your neighborhood. The reality was not romantic. It was dirty. It was loud. It smelled. You didn't live on the wrong side of the tracks. You lived under the tracks. And in some cases, their buildings had been demolished because they were worth more for parking than as buildings. So it had sort of put the neighborhood in a deep freeze, which for some people like me is interesting. But from an economic standpoint, you know, it's not sustainable in a city like this. So a lot of people wanted to tear the High Line down and get on with it. And that's where Amanda Burden, who is the planning chair for the Bloomberg administration, came in and did a rezoning that allowed the property rights to be transferred within a district. It's what saved, you know, most people think it's Jackie O that saved Grand Central, which she did. But the legal mechanism was they allowed the railroad that owned Grand Central, ironically, to transfer their development rights anywhere in the neighborhood. Normally, you can only transfer it to your neighbor. It also saved the theaters in Times Square in the 90s. You know, it's used very infrequently. But Amanda passed this very complicated rezoning that allowed these developers to actually make money off owning property under the High Line. And then that's what got them on board.
Who were some of your unlikely supporters in the early days?
Well, we had Florent, but I mean, that didn't surprise. You know, Florent had this restaurant on Gansevoort Street that really was one of the early pioneers in the meat market. And he put us in touch with Diane von Furstenberg, who had a store in the neighborhood.
The designer married to Barry Diller, who runs Interactive Corporation.
Yeah, and her son and Barry, you know, really got behind the project and was one of our first really big, you know, financial supporters. Edward Norton was another one, the actor. He read an article that Adam Gopnik wrote about Joel's photos of the High Line that was in the New Yorker. And he read it and looked us up in information and called up Josh. And Josh was just sort of talking to him, and he said, Edward Norton. And then halfway through, he said, are you? And he said, yes, I'm Edward Norton, the actor. And so he said, oh, I really want to help. He mailed us a check right away, would show up at meetings, go to community board meetings. I mean, he actually really dug in.
You also had a lot of support from the gay community in the West Village. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Josh and I are both gay. And, you know, I think we thought traditionally, you know, nonprofits were run by people on the Upper East Side that you see in the style section of the New York Times or, you know, just famous rich people. And in the beginning, they weren't that interested in this project. So we tapped the people that we knew, which was our friends, which was a lot of gay people. I mean, one of my straight friends from college came to one of our first events, and he was like, wow, there are a lot of men here. You know, he didn't get it was all gay men except him. Herbert Muschamp, who was the old architecture critic for the Times, has this great quote about the story of preservation in New York is the alliance of gay men and rich women, straight women.
Speaking of straight women, there was a woman, Betsy Barlow Rogers, who founded the Central Park Conservancy. She was helpful to you.
Well, I mean, one, it's great. She's from San Antonio, my hometown. She went to high school with my dad. What she did is she created a private group that partnered with the Parks Department and the city to turn around Central Park and then help run it. And so, you know, without that precedent, the High Line was so unlikely, I don't think we could have ever pioneered yet a new model. And same with Dan Biederman at Bryant Park. And we were lucky to have a willing partner. You know, Bloomberg was willing, even though we had never done this before, was willing to see us as a credible partner.
In addition to help from Betsy, you also received help from a couple of classmates of yours from Princeton, one of whom was Gifford Miller.
Yeah, so Gifford was actually my boyfriend's roommate in college. When I first called up Gifford, he was a city council person, I think one of the youngest city council person ever elected at the time. And he said, well, that's a really stupid idea.
No, to you.
Yeah. And he said, why don't you call Christine Quinn? She's a local city council. You know, he was basically pawning me off. And Christine was actually much more supportive. But then we got Gifford to go up there, and Gifford really fell in love with it. And then another one of my best friends from college, Mario Palumbo, became our treasurer. He helped get his boss on board, a guy named Phil Ahrens. And he was a developer. And he helped give us a lot of credibility because all the developers in the neighborhood and the city thought it was a bad idea. So here was a really successful New York developer that was saying, this makes sense.
Robert Caro, or Bob Caro, who's the author of Power Broker, a book about Robert Moses, he came up with you one day to look at the High Line. And that was sort of one of your personal high points in all this. How come?
Well, I got a message on my machine, you know, from Bob Caro, and I was just over the moon, you know. And I took him and his wife up on a tour of, you know, when the High Line was still wild. And he was so excited about the project, and he was so complimentary to me. And that's when it really first started sinking in that, wow, I might be doing something really special. I read his book right when I moved to New York. It's such a great primer mm-hmm. on everything about New York. Mm-hmm. And there's a great section in The Power Broker where it talks about how Robert Moses builds the West Side Improvement Project, which was part of the High Line. And it cost $150 million in 1930, so equivalent to the Big Dig, you know, now. And he goes through several pages about how he got the money piece by piece by piece. And I'm not a real Robert Moses fan, but it was also just sort of inspiring to see, you know, it doesn't come at once. You don't have to see how you're going to get the money. And so I always kept those pages, you know, by my, I'd Xeroxed them and they were, you know, by my desk.
In that way, you're similar to Robert Moses, but Robert Caro, who went up there, actually thought that your project was the inverse of something
yes.
Moses would do.
Yeah, I mean, he liked the irony that it was helped created by a Robert Moses project, but that Robert Moses would probably not have liked it.
Why?
You know, because it was a bottom-up project. You know, Robert Moses' project were the ultimate projects of top-down, you know, of government authority pushing it through, you know, against community support, where this project really started in the community and then sort of bubbled up.
You raised $150 million for phase one and two of the project. And this, by the way, the project was full steam ahead really during an economic crisis in 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about that? Did you ever feel, you know, maybe this money could be used for schools? Or what was your psychology around that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we realized early on, and a guy who's also one of the people that's been really important to the project, a guy named John Alschuler, helped us do an economic feasibility study and to show how this would become an economic generator for the city. And, you know, that it wasn't, that it really made economic sense, that this was a good investment. And it's turned out to be, you know, true beyond our wildest dreams. You know, it's generated over $2 billion in development already. And we estimate it'll be about $900 million that'll be returned to the city in additional real estate taxes over 20 years.
People have said about you that you are a superior marketer, and that obviously, you know, that helped.
Yeah. You know, I think to me, one of the things that was important for me was the graphic identity and sort of graphics, which Paula Scher did our logo, you know, a few months after we started, and it's now the logo for the park. And so in a very early stage, we put a real emphasis on the graphics, and it was twofold. One, to make people think we had more going on than we did and that they'd want to get involved, but it was also that it was a commitment that we were going to follow through on good design.
And this is at a time when, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple are, you know, gaining acceleration. You have the iPod. How much of that was in your thoughts?
I remember that. I remember those iPod. We actually knocked off one of those early iPod ads for one of our events. But it was a commitment that we weren't just going to put up a planter and put up a stair and call it a day.
You look a little bit, I think, like Jimmy Stewart, you know, and he was in this movie Rear Window by Alfred Hitchcock. And I actually think of Rear Window
yeah.
when I'm walking on the High Line, because it's about just being up close with your neighbors. And you have people walking on the High Line and, you know, peeping in.
Yeah.
People are voyeurs like myself. And, you know, we like to see what's going on in the residences around you. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, that dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we really... we loved about when we first heard the design team is in their first interview. One I love because they were arguing amongst themselves in their interview, which I liked. But they also used the word, I think Liz Diller used it, was the word illicit. You felt like you were doing something, you know, not like hardcore illegal, but, you know, like riding your bike the wrong way on a street or something. And then, you know, right after we opened, the first big scandal was that the New York Post did a big story about, you know, people standing on the High Line watching people have sex in the Standard Hotel, which is right above the High Line, which is a little bit, I mean, I look all the time and I never see it, but, you know, so it's become almost like an urban myth, and you'll see tourists just planted, staring up, you know, waiting for something, hoping something's going to happen in the hotel windows. But, you know, I also think usually when you go up in buildings in New York, you go to the Empire State Building, you know, you're at this high vantage point and people look like ants. The High Line, you're just, you know, 30 feet above the street. So you can make eye contact with people on the street. It has this very different feeling and experiencing the city. It makes the city almost look quainter, not as majestic.
By the way, what do you do as a hobby?
I used to be more of a painter. I didn't study it, but I started sort of taking it up in the 90s. And right before I started the High Line, I'd had a few very, very small shows. And but lately, I haven't been painting that much.
You meditate daily. What kind of meditation do you do, and what does it do for you?
It's just a mantra-based meditation. So I learned to meditate, you know, several years ago, and it's just I do it 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. And I always hit, I think like most people, this sort of a low or this wall, you know, I don't know, some glucose shortfall, you know, around 3 or 4. And so I originally would go back. We had an old storage closet, and I would go back there to meditate. And gradually more and more people at the office have learned, and now there's almost 10 of us. And a lot of us, you know, every day at around 4, sometimes 6, we'll go back in the storage closet and meditate together.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. My guest has been Robert Hammond, co-founder of The High Line.
Coming up, we'll meet Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo, the first company to make digital video recorders, or DVRs, which allow consumers to record TV programs, skip over ads, or watch the programs at their convenience. Jim started TiVo in 1997 with his partner Michael Ramsey. Jim worked at Hewlett-Packard, Bell Labs, and Silicon Graphics prior to starting TiVo. Welcome.
Well, thanks. Thank you very much.
So, Jim, what role did TV play in your life growing up?
As a child, I was raised with the TV in the house. I even have some very dim memories of the transition from black and white to color television. I watched every episode of Star Trek many times and could repeat a lot of the dialogue. I was like a lot of men, I think, in terms of once you got the remote control, you just sit there and flip channels. And looking for something interesting to watch. I don't do that anymore.
I notice how you said a lot of men use the remote control. It's so true. Why don't you think more women use the remote control for surfing television as much as men do?
I don't know. Maybe we're just more easily bored by the stuff that's on television.
You got your bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and your master's degree in computer science. Did you have any idea then that you would be working on television projects, or what did you want to do with those degrees, did you think?
When I left college, it was really a focus on computers and computer networking, programming, things like that. It wasn't until I was working for Silicon Graphics in the early 90s that I started to get involved with television. And digital television.
You left Silicon Graphics in 1996. When you left, you started your own company called Network Age Software. What was the goal for this company?
Well, in working with especially the full service network and looking at all the interactive TV work that had gone on, I felt that there was an opportunity in the management and moving around of huge amounts of digital information. The movies, for instance, that were played back over the Time Warner, the video on demand system, were simply massive, many gigabytes of data. So I felt there's an opportunity to build software to manage how you move data around. I had developed that company for about a year, and at that time, Mike had just left Silicon Graphics. And so I called him up and said, let's do lunch. We had a nice lunch, but we started talking about how we both were very interested in starting up something from scratch. And as we started talking, we both came to the notion that there was going to be an opportunity in the home for people, that music was starting to be digital, most television content and movie content would be digital over time, and that we had an opportunity there to put together a company and a product that would help people in managing all this stuff in your home.
Incidentally, you had been a good soldier working at Hewlett-Packard and Bell Labs and Silicon Graphics, these very large companies, and here you are now venturing out on your own, first by yourself and then with Michael. How did you feel?
Well, as you point out, I'd been, coddled in the big corporate world for a while, and the thought of stepping out on my own and trying something was scary, frankly. But after a while, it was as if a weight had lifted off my shoulders, because working for SGI had actually been very stressful, and I didn't quite realize how stressful it was until I left. And at that point, I started feeling much better about the decision and stopped being afraid.
Do you remember some of the early days when, or some of those first mornings when you woke up and you didn't have to get in the car and go to work?
Yeah, I do. One part of it was disciplining myself to be able to, you go and you eat breakfast and do whatever and then sit down and work. Mm-hmm. I hadn't really sat down and worked at home before.
How did your wife feel about it?
Well, frankly, at the time, she said, you need to do whatever is right for you. Just make sure we don't lose the house. And so I made sure we didn't lose the house.
You and Michael decide to start this company together. But the project that you were working on initially was far from the TiVo product that you ultimately developed. You started to create a home network system where you would have a sensor in the refrigerator telling the consumer when their milk was sour. Could you give other examples of the practical implications of what the technology that this home network system could do?
We had the notion that you'd be able to plug your camera in and download pictures off of your camera. That you would have one of these small satellite set-tops that connected to your home stereo system and allow you to play back your music. It might hook to your phone system and be a sort of a personal voicemail. I have a slide that I did at that time where I put all these things on one slide, and we called it the Grand Vision slide. I think I had a coffee maker on there that might be controlled. It was a field of dreams. But as we dove in to fleshing it out and starting to line up the technologies we'd need to actually make this stuff work, it became clear that the networking technology available at that time wasn't going to be sufficient to handle the kinds of kept data that we were thinking about moving around. I don't remember exactly how it happened, but Mike and I were sitting around and talking one day, and it might have been with some other people too, and somebody said, well, wouldn't it be great if you could pause live television? And I thought, well, that's sort of an interesting notion. I wonder if we could do that. And as I sat there for a minute, I went, I understand enough about computers and digital content and everything. I could do that. I could figure out how to do that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. Jim founded TiVo in 1997 with his partner Michael Ramsey, and the company was first profitable in 2005.
So finally, you had this aha moment where you said, okay, let's focus our technology on building this device for television. Talk to me about how venture capitalists receive this idea.
The initial idea was this home server on a home network distributing media throughout your home. And it was interesting. The two venture firms that we worked with, NEA and IVP, both had partners at those firms that knew Mike and I from previous experiences at Silicon Graphics. I remember one of the partners, his name was Jeff Yang. He says, you know, this is a crazy idea. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I'll bet you guys are going to come up with something. So they didn't really fund us based on the idea. They funded us based on it being Mike and I.
So you were well received by the venture capital community, but did you expect the degree of controversy that would come from elsewhere, you know, from the TV, the cable companies?
You mean in terms of skipping ads?
Exactly.
Yes and no. I didn't particularly like watching commercials, and I was more than happy to build a device that could allow you to skip over them. At the same time, we knew that the networks especially, who derived all their revenue from advertising, would be very nervous about this technology. So we went to them very early on at TiVo, and we said, look at what we're building. Said, you know, this thing is coming, but in years down the road, it's going to be very common. And what you should do is get on board now. In fact, we think you should invest in TiVo and make sure that instead of running away from this thing, that you're part of it. You know, if you're going to take away the 30-second spot, then we felt we needed to give back other ways of advertising, other ways of reaching the consumer within TiVo. And so we developed quite a large number of different kinds of interactive advertising technologies that are still with us today.
So what was their response?
Well, it depends. Advertisers were actually quite excited about the potential and the possibilities that we were showing them, new ways to advertise to get beyond the 30-second spot. The networks were sort of split. There were some that were very far-sighted, and there were other entities that were very afraid.
And didn't one network executive ask Michael if he was the devil?
that he probably did.
Were you in that meeting?
No, I wasn't. Michael tended to be the guy out talking a lot to everybody, where I like to be, you know, back in the lab working on actually making things work.
You talk about other potential revenue models for the networks if you were going to be threatening these 30-second ads, and that raises an issue of privacy concerns. You know, you'd have to inherently be giving or releasing data about your viewers because you have this information, and that caused some viewers to, you know, feel uncomfortable.
Well, we were very concerned about maintaining people's privacy but still being able to build a business. You know, the engineers at TiVo, especially in those days, in the early days, we were all a bunch of libertarian software engineers, and we didn't want anybody invading our privacy either. So we were very careful about how we constructed the systems for collecting data in such a way that we could guarantee people's privacy and still be able to aggregate the kind of information that networks and advertisers would really want to have. In fact, early on, we had a customer who hooked up to the phone line going in and out of the TiVo and saw the data going back and forth and called up his congressman who asked the FTC to investigate us, which was fine because we were able to demonstrate to the FTC, to their total satisfaction, that we couldn't go and back and correlate the data that came back to us with an individual.
While you had a relatively easy time raising capital, whether it was from the venture capitalists or from some of the media companies like NBC or AOL, which invested $200 million, you faced a lot of hurdles elsewhere, for instance, in just by consumers. Consumer adoption wasn't as quick, perhaps, as you thought it would be. Were you surprised by the lackluster response of consumers in the early days? I know people were very excited about this new technology, but it really took a while for consumer adoption to ramp up.
Yes, it did. And I think we were surprised about that because, having built prototypes and everybody in the company took them home and lived with these things, we all understood how life-changing the technology was. I think the problem that we face that we didn't quite understand at first was that for most people, they didn't think of television as being broken. So coming in with a new concept that says, now you actually can totally control your viewing, most people didn't quite compute that at first because there wasn't a space in it in their head that neatly fit into. And so in the early days, a lot of our efforts were around education of the market.
One of the challenges to consumer adoption might have been the price. TiVo was $499 plus a $9.95 a month fee on top of that. And you took efforts to subsidize that price. What are some other examples of some hurdles that you faced early on, aside from the consumer adoption issue?
The early days of TiVo were sort of a heady time. You know, we were there in that phase of the expansion of the internet bubble. We went public in September of 1999. The stock was priced at $16 and hit $78 on that same day. Of course, not long after that, we had the bursting, if you will, of the internet bubble, and funding dried up. I remember when we had to make the very difficult decision in 2001 to lay off people in the company. And having to do a layoff was a huge emotional downer because we had so built the company on taking care of people. But we really had no choice if we wanted to stay in business. And then what happened was Philips and Sony and some of the other partners you're working with decided that they didn't want to work with us anymore because we wouldn't pay them a subsidy anymore on their products. And so we got to a point where we were down to our last tens of millions of dollars in the bank and had no distribution. And we sat around and looked at each other and said, we're not quitting. If we have to, we'll throw these things on the back of a truck and we'll drive them around and sell them on the back of the truck. We never quite had to do that because by that time, Best Buy had become very interested in TiVo, the brand, and we signed a deal with them where they distributed TiVo boxes, and that allowed us to skate through that time of thin amounts of money and come out the other side in a way as strong or stronger than we'd ever been.
Just on an existential level, since you really were the pioneer behind the DVR or the digital video recorder, how do you feel about being on the founding team that developed this technology, which, you know, is becoming more pervasive, even if it's not in the form of a TiVo machine?
Well, I've found it incredibly gratifying. It still happens today, but in the early days, I'd be talking to somebody and say, oh, yeah, I'm with TiVo. And it was like, TiVo, you're with TiVo? That's the greatest thing in the world. I've had people come up and say, you know, my three-year-old can use the TiVo. It's so easy to use. My grandmother uses it with no trouble at all. It's interesting to me that a lot of the technology that we developed, we've been able to license to a lot of different people. It's used in quite a few different DVRs that aren't under the TiVo brand. So from a pure technology intellectual property point of view, it's also gratifying to have developed something that has become so pervasive for people in their lives.
even the word TiVo has become generic and is used as a verb, you know, oh, I TiVo this show, I TiVo that show, you know, kind of like Kleenex or Band-Aids. How did you feel about that term becoming generic?
You know, it's a two-faced thing. It's really gratifying to have created a verb, created a whole concept for people that they want to talk about it that way. On the other hand, the control of TiVo, there's a particular whole set of legal steps that we need to take to protect our trademark, to protect that verb. And so we have to take actual action to tell people when they use TiVo as a generic verb that, no, you can't do that.
How did you come up with the name originally?
Teleworld was the name we came up with originally when we first got funded by the venture capitalists. It was really a placeholder name until we went through a whole exercise, a naming exercise, and started off with 800 names on a wall. What we did at the company is we actually took all the different names that had been thought of and posted them on the walls. And then everybody got a sticker that they could go and stick on whichever piece of paper had the name that they liked. There was a formal acknowledgement that there was Texas and California, which is me and Mike, and that we got the big vote in the end.
Well, Jim, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure. I'm pleased and flattered that you asked me to join.
My guest has been Jim Barton, co-founder of TiVo. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.